greatest single cause of atheism in the world today is Christians, who acknowledge Jesus with their lips and walk out the door and deny him by their lifestyle. That is what an unbelieving world simply finds unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to Winds of Change. This is your host and Bible teacher, Keith McKenzie. And today we're in session 34. We did not find the other two sessions, which would be 32 and 33. We will try and find that, but we're going to go ahead and move along with the series and try and locate those files down the road. So this is session 34. We'll be looking at some of the modern translations moving up into the NASB, but we'll go ahead and let Pastor Conway go ahead with our study on bibliology.
All right. We're continuing, and we're winding down, and just a few more weeks. Want to, after this, five more weeks, I think, we want to look at and take an honest look at some of these modern translations. We've already looked at from the Wycliffe all the way up to the King James, and then that's kind of how we divided it up. And then from the King James forward, in terms of the issues of translations, we've covered a whole lot more ground before that, other than that. And we're working our way up to some of the newer translations. I think we'll end, we'll talk about, you know, even though we've talked about it some more, but we'll talk about, you know, formal equivalent and dynamic and so forth. We'll talk about it a little bit tonight, but we'll kind of wrap up with that. But we'll look at our last formal session. Will probably be the last thing we'll look at is probably the Message. And then we'll wrap up, as I mentioned, with a quiz, just to see where we are, and then we'll go right into eschatology. We'll jump right into that as well, right after. In it'll be 5 weeks after this week. All right, same week we do section 14. Yeah. I'll tell you. I'll give you a clue. All the answers were contained in the study. So it's open book, open Bible, if you could find it. Yeah. But we're moving fast. We're gonna move fast. Yeah. I'm trying to think if I did start the eschatology study with a quiz too. So we'll have back-to-back quizzes. We'll have a quiz to end this, and then we'll start eschatology with a quiz. But it'll be one of those just to kind of test our knowledge. So, fun stuff. But, you know, as we look at these modern translations, you know, like I said last week, part of why we're doing this is to get a sense of what has gone into some of these translations. And we'll also look at, you know, some of the criticisms that some of these translations have faced over the years and as they were put out there. Not all of them, you know, received full green light as others have. And but then again, you know, as we go through this, you'll get a sense of, you know, where I stand on some of them. For example, you know, the Message, for example, is one that, you know, I just say I don't even recommend that really. But again, you know, is it the most awful thing out there? Perhaps not. But it's a commentary, if you will. But otherwise, I'm presenting some information so that as you're out there looking at translations and perhaps, you know, you've already settled on what you're going to use, or maybe you're going to think about buying somebody a translation. And Maya asked me the other day, you know, if I lead somebody to Christ at school, you know, what translation should I buy? I mean, we talked about that. And so, you know, sometimes it's helpful to know that kind of thing, and know some of the little ins and outs about some of these translations. And so we're working our way up to some of those, the newer ones that have been out in just a few years ago, for example, the Net Bible and the Message and so forth. And so there was a special universal edition of the RSV we talked about last week, or we mentioned the RSV came out in 46 and 52. But there's a special universal edition of the RSV introduced in 1966. And it would be a common Bible for Roman Catholics, Protestants, and Orthodox. So, Roman Catholics, Protestants, Orthodox, all right? So they produce what is called the New Oxford Annotated Bible. Now, that's not a Bible, as George mentioned last week. You don't see the ton around much anymore. But it's important in the sense, and the reason why I mentioned it was meant to be a common Bible, all right? So the New Oxford Annotated Bible, and I think I have in parentheses there, in your notes, with Apocrypha. We're in section 6, part 9, by the way. If you had the chart, you'd see that as the New Revised Standard Version, you'd probably see it written as that, NRSV. All right? That's how we'll see it sometimes. And if you search online right now and you search for the New Oxford Annotated Bible, you'll see it pop up as NRSV. New Revised Standard Version. So, and you might see it as the longer title, the New Oxford Annotated Bible, New Revised Standard Version with Apocrypha. Long title. And then in footnotes, you'll see an Ecumenical Study Bible. All right? So it's called the NOAB. You might see it as that. And in the preface of the NOAB, it's explained the apocryphal books. And they say this about the Apocrypha. Remember, we spent a lot of time talking about the Apocrypha. These are intertestamental books of things that, some of them are things that happened in between, or to the Jews in between the intertestamental period. And it wasn't, it's not scripture, but some of them good for history. But they say this in their preface: the Old Testament Apocrypha provides valuable source materials for the understanding of the history and culture of post-Old Testament Judaism and for appreciating the background of the New Testament. Now, from what we've gone through so far in this study, would we agree with that so far? You want me to read it again? All right, let me read it again and see. The Old Testament Apocrypha provides valuable source materials for the understanding of the history and culture of post-Old Testament Judaism and for appreciating the background of the New Testament. No? You wouldn't? Why? Okay. All right. All right. Okay. So some, maybe if they put the word some books, Maccabees, you know, perhaps, all right? Maybe they should say little. Yeah, and Bell and the Dragon and all those. So some of that is true. There's some of the books provide some historical stuff. You know, we spent quite a bit of time. But they continue with this. They say, although the Christian churches have taken divergent attitudes toward the books of the Apocrypha, and Catholics and Protestants have taken different views as to their authority, the writing then of the Apocrypha belongs to the common heritage of the Church from Judaism, and they have been part of the translations of the Bible from the 1611 King James, the English Revised Version, the RV, and the RSV. So they kind of go out there with that. And so it should be also noted that from the same preface there that they wrote all this, that beyond including the Apocrypha and saying that it sheds light on the intertestamental period, it was also included to promote ecumenism. They said that, all right? So you could see we're talking about Orthodox, Catholics, and Protestants. Some different views out there about the Apocrypha, but they were trying to find some common ground. By the way, what was one of the things that kind of split up the, kind of kept the Orthodox and the Catholics apart? Anybody remember one of the big issues? Maybe that's one of them. There's a statement they call the Filioque statement. You ever heard that? When you look at the Nicene Creed, it says that where does the Holy Spirit come from? It says from the Father and from the Son. The Orthodox don't believe in that part about from the Son. They just had from the Father. So if you go to one of these ecumenical services where Orthodox are there and Catholics are there, they will leave it out. And it's interesting, as people are saying it, the people who say that statement are the Catholics, and the Orthodox leave that statement out. But that was one of the big things. They kind of rejoined again. They found some common ground, and then that whole statement again split them apart again. So you have the Orthodox Church and you have the Catholic Church being divided over that statement. So sometimes, you know, doctrine can divide, as some people say. But they say it was included to promote ecumenism. But unfortunately, what happened is that this translation hasn't served to bring people together. You know, they were hoping that they would bring people together over a serious study of Scripture, and it didn't do that. But the only thing that it did was to bring liberal theologians together. Because when you really think about it, who would, when you think about those groups, it's really perhaps liberal people that would get together. George mentioned the Moonies this morning in Sunday school, and I think I've shared this story before, but maybe 5 years ago, 4 years ago or so, we had a couple come here, not for a service, but they came after a service. I don't know if anybody remembered. And one Sunday they were looking for me, and I wasn't here or wasn't available, and so they talked to some other folks here. And then they came back again looking for me, and they handed me this video, and they said, "Watch this." And so I brought it home and I watched it, and they were just talking about, you know, how we should all get together. And it was a video of a Baptist preacher, an imam, a rabbi, and a priest. And I think that's it. Bless you. Coming together for a rally, if you will. And so, you know, I brought the video back and I gave it to them. I told them not to come again. And they haven't been here since. But that's what this had served to do, is to bring people who want to put aside these things, these differences, or put aside doctrine and come together. And so it didn't seek to bring people together for serious study. Now, in later editions of the NOAB, it started to contain even more notes and comments by much more liberal scholars. So as time went along, it got a little bit more liberal, and that's what makes it dangerous. Let me give you an example. Turn to Exodus 14. Exodus chapter 14. And some of what, as I mentioned, what makes it dangerous are the notes that these people put in it. In Exodus 14, what's going on in this chapter? We see Pharaoh's pursuing the Israelites. And he wants to kill them. And we see in verse 13, "But Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever.'" Verse 14, "The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. As for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen." All right, then the rest of the story we see verse 21. "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land, so the waters were divided. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand, on their left hand. Then the Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses his chariots and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. It must have been interesting to see that. Can you imagine if the fish were swimming and they're just kind of hitting that wall and kind of turning around? It must be neat. Look at verse 28. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained, but the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Now, so we see that the issue now with the translation is not with the translation or with the words in the New Oxford Annotated. The issue is with the notes that they put in there in terms of study notes for this. This is what the notes say. They say the sea, known in Hebrew as the Sea of Reeds, is not the Red Sea itself, but a shallow body of water further north. You perhaps have heard this. Perhaps the area of Lake Timshah. The divine victory which they achieved was rooted in a natural phenomena. During a storm, the waters were driven back by a strong east wind, making it possible for the Israelites to cross on foot. The Egyptian chariots, however, was mired in the mud and engulfed by the returning water. Tradition heightened the miracle by attributing it to Moses' wonder-working rod and by saying that the water stood up like walls. And so, yes. Yeah, that over time the story got bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah, you know, they're saying like it's when you go out and you catch a fish, you know, that's a foot long, all of a sudden it starts becoming this, and yeah. So that's basically what they're saying. You know, they're saying this is a small thing, but with time it grew bigger and bigger. And so they're saying that the real sea really is really shallow. And the east wind came in, kind of blew it back, and the children of Israel crossed. This is what C.S. Lewis said in his day. He responded to that by saying that if that's the case, then God did an even greater miracle because he drowned the entire army in 2 feet of water. Interesting, huh? Good comeback. And so the point is that, you know, there's a lot of liberal notes like this that will fill that Bible. And so, you know, when you start to see that, that's a dangerous path to take. Thoughts or comments, questions on that? Yeah, it's just as time went along, more and more liberal notes just started creeping in. And that's just one example. You know, one of those that we looked at also earlier on in terms of errors. And it's something that's always picked on. You know, it's not the Red Sea, it's the Reed Sea, you know, all these types of things.
I think some of those views were shared by Morris Ashcraft. Had that kind of a slide to him. Natural explanations for everything.
Yeah.
Really complete denial of God's unexplainable miracles.
Yeah. Some of it creep into some of the colleges too, I think, right? Didn't they lose all their colleges when they came back and kept some of the seminaries? I think that's how it kind of worked out.
They lost some of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know one fellow that we had befriended established a Bible college in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Was very conservative. Not have happened there.
Right.
And the seminaries, for the most part, have been sound.
Right. I don't think the colleges have. Yeah, I don't think so. I think the seminaries were pretty good. And then you had people like Adrian Rogers, Charles Stanley, those kind of people who kind of took the reins.
Not
yeah.
All the seminaries were the same.
Right.
Southern seminaries probably the most liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Southwestern is probably the most conservative.
Right. Yeah, and they're still around doing well. Yeah. Ray.
So when a Bible is...
No, the publishers, and so remember we were talking about the RSV last week, for example, and just a, you know, any Bible translation. There's a group of people that work on the first edition, later editions, and so forth. And so as the later editions come about, those group of people would then add their commentaries to it. So it's almost like a study Bible, if you will, and they're putting the notes in there. And over time, those notes got more and more liberal because of the group of people changed. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It sounds like the Jesus seminar is based on the Oxford Annotated. When they did the old series of the Jesus seminars, they're trying to compare with the natural events that happened.
Yeah.
That was a big influence on that.
Perhaps, right. Because, you know, you talk to some people and it's hard to... You know, like we looked at some of these miracles before, you know, and if you could believe Genesis 1:1, you could believe anything, you know. And I was talking with somebody the other day, and we were talking about Jonah, and they just see it as a story with a moral good, you know, that Jonah wasn't literally inside of a fish. But, yeah, so some people really can't get there.
As well have National Geographic write the commentary and be done with
it. Right. Yeah, might as well. They would do just as good a job, right? Yeah. So, well, let's move on to the next one, the development of the New American Standard Bible. The dates there are 63 and 71. The New Testament was completed in 1963, followed by the Old Testament in 1971. Now, there were some modifications made to the completed 71 version in 1972, 73, 75, and 77. And then nothing was done again until it was fully updated in 1995. So the version I use is the 1995 version. That was the last update. And so the New American Standard Bible is considered by a lot of people to be one of the most accurate, understandable text out there in terms of a modern translation that's done literally. One of the things that you see in the preface of the NASB, the translation team, they had a fourfold aim. One, these publications shall be true to the original Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. They shall be grammatically correct. They shall be understandable. And they shall give the Lord Jesus Christ his proper place, the place which the Word gives him. Therefore, no work will ever be personalized. And so, as the name applies, it is a revision of the ASV of 1901. Remember, we talked about the ASV, and we said that the ASV was widely used in the seminaries, remember? Except it took some heat because of what? You remember? Its use of the name Jehovah. They use that in terms in place of God. And so you start to see the Jehovah Witness latch onto it. And so, you know, that kind of slowed it down a little bit. But otherwise, the seminaries kind of latched onto it. You know, and you could see by its name, the American Standard Version. And sometimes they call it the Standard Bible. And so we talked about that. If you look at your charts for a moment, and if you have them, just so we're clear, in the middle of the second page, we have the King James Bible, all right? So follow along. Then the RV was done after the King James Version. Then the ASV came out to update some language and to make it more readable. Then that started to be have some problems. So some folks who... some people consider liberal scholars came in and they took the RV and the ASV and they made the RSV, all right? So now the NASB is based off the ASV, which was based off the RV. Everybody get that? All right, just follow your charts, all right? And so the ASV was its English base, and the NASB translators revised the ASV as literally as possible. And they put this under their principles of interpretation. They said, when it was felt that the word-for-word literalness was unacceptable to the modern reader, a change was made in the direction of a more current English idiom in the instances where this has been done, the more literal rendering has been indicated in the notes. And so what that is saying is, in cases where, you know, there's a saying involved, some kind of saying, they may not have done a word-for-word translation on that saying, but they will use, perhaps they use a statement that was more common to our day, but then they would put the more literal one in the margin. That's what they're saying. So the NASB was much more readily accepted than the ASV because of its return to the use of the word Lord, capital L-O-R-D, instead of Jehovah. And we looked at that last week. And so in the NASB, they try to designate this by the typeset. And again, we discussed that last week. You know, when we talked about with the NASB when it first came out, some thought that it had regressed because in the ASV they use a paragraph format, and perhaps you have Bibles that use a paragraph format where the verses are embedded in the paragraph. For preaching, I like to have the verses separate. You know, it's easier to kind of find it. But when you're reading it in a paragraph, you know, it's nice to see that paragraph from start to finish so you get the full flavor of it. So some people accused it of regressing because it abandoned that paragraph format that the ASV had, and they returned to a verse-by-verse format. And so what the NASB has done since then is that they have made the verse numbers of a paragraph bolded. And so if you have an ASB and you look at that, you'll see, you know, where the paragraph starts, that verse number is bolded, and then you could see where the paragraphs are. And so in 1992, the Lockman Foundation, they commissioned a limited revision of the NASB. It was called the updated edition, and sometimes you'll see it as the NASB 1995 edition. Why did they do that? Because there were changes in the English language, such as grammar changes, and they wanted to reflect some of that. And so, you know, if you have a 77 edition of the NASB, it's still, the 95 version is still called the NASB. Even though it kind of supplanted the 77 text. So for the most part, when you buy an NASB now, you're buying the 1995 version with a couple exceptions. Is your Schofield a 77? I think so. The one you had this morning?
Schofield is this. No, I don't know.
The one you had? Yeah, you had it this morning.
Yeah. No, I think it's the later one. Because it's different than Gene's. Gene has the earlier one.
And it still has some these and thous, right?
There is
thous. Yeah, right. The 77 does. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And
he
has 77.
Yeah. NASB?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mine's a 99.
Okay.
NASB.
NASB.
An 85.
Okay. 85 or?
Yeah.
Yeah. And is a printing date?
Oh, okay. Copyright 85 by Holman Publishers. And then down below it has 72, 73, 75, and 77.
Yep. So it says copyright, but the edition of that is the 77. Yeah, yeah. And they did it not because they disagreed with the 77 when they updated it, was but because they wanted to change some grammar and some, you know, and some things like that, and so the updated NASB, they looked at some different manuscripts and they kind of compared and tried to pull in some more updated things that were found. Now in the earlier edition of the NASB, you might find some these and thous, you know, in some of the earlier ones. In the newer ones, they've replaced some of that. But let's talk about some of the manuscripts that they use. For example, in the third page, or the second and third page, you'll see the Nestle's manuscript. Remember we talked about family of manuscripts that are out there, Alexandrian and so forth. They relied a lot on the Nestle's manuscript, or also the Biblica Hebraica, and along with the most updated things they found from the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example. And so the biblical scholars learned a lot, especially when the beginnings of the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 1949. And they kept finding scrolls through the 80s, and I believe up until 8 years ago they found one more scroll. But what happened is that these scrolls shed a lot of light on certain Hebrew words. And so the updated NASB represents the revisions and refinements, and it has some current English usage and vocabulary and grammar. They kind of try to smooth out the reading and to have a better readability. And they said this: at no point did the translators attempt to interpret scripture through translation. Remember, we looked at a couple instances last week where, or in the past, where people have interpreted scripture. And we'll look at a couple examples later on when we look at the NIV as well. But they say, instead, the NASB translation team adhered to the principles of literal translation. Instead of telling the reader what to think, the updated edition provides the most precise translation with which to conduct a personal journey through the Word of God. In other words, they're just trying to translate the scriptures, they say, without making any interpretive decision. And that's what we'll see going forward. Some translations will make some interpretive decisions. Now, a lot of these interpretive decisions that are made are right. They're correct. But what you have to think about is, do I want somebody interpreting it for me, or do I want to interpret myself? And even when we look at the NIV, a lot of the interpretations are right, or the ESV, you know, sometimes they interpret it correctly. So it's a matter of whether you agree with that or not. And so since the 1995 edition, we said that these and thous have been changed to you and your when it relates directly to the references to God. Because in the 1901 ASV, which this comes from, it used those terms in relation to everyone, okay? And that there was a time where, remember, people spoke that way, as we could see in the 1611 King James. And if any criticism is given, then it would be that, as we discussed before, that some people see using thy and thee and thou as a more reverent language when it comes to referring to God. And a lot of people feel that way. But nonetheless, a lot of Bible teachers have a high regard for this translation. A lot of people switched over to it because of its literalness and readability. You know, what you're starting to see is a lot of people are switching to the, not a lot, some people are switching to the ESV. You know, some people perhaps who didn't switch to the NASB, and some people who switch to the NASB are switching to the ESV as well. But you still see a lot of people using the King James. As I told you, when I went over to Belmont Street, that was their preference of a translation, was the King James. You know, and they really like it because of how close it is to the original, and yet it reads well. It reads pretty good. You know, in Romans 1:16, it says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." And we'll talk about the NIV in a minute. But what it says in the NIV is, "I am not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God of salvation for it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew and then for the Greek, the Gentile." This is the 1984 version. You know, actually, let's jump into the NIV, the development of the NIV, and we'll talk about some of these, the translation philosophies here. Yep. What do you think? What's the gospel? What's the gospel? You know, it's one of those things where, you know, the thought would be that in later manuscripts, You know, you see it in some, you don't see it in other. And so they made a decision that, you know, what's the gospel? The death, the burial, and resurrection of Christ. You know, so does it change the meaning or, you know, so it's one of those things. You know, that's why when we come to talk about translations for Awana, and when we get to that, you know, we have to look seriously at all these types of things. And, you know, we use the King James now. And, you know, if anything, I think we might switch to the New King James, perhaps. But it's one of those things that it kind of sticks with you, right? And the same thing in the NIV. It says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. You know, the it's one of those principles we looked at before, that you see it in some manuscripts and you say, all right, was it there? Does it change anything in terms of the meaning? It's a personal preference. All right? Holman says the gospel.
I'm not ashamed of the gospel.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's look at the NIV. The NIV was published in 1973 and 78, respectively, right? It is a more phrase-for-phrase translation than a word-for-word. And the scholars were generally conservative scholars. However, many people will say that its flaw is in its simplicity of language. The editors of the NIV wanted to make sure that it was easy to read. And so in achieving this goal, they often sacrifice accuracy in some cases. And what we see in the last 40 years is that there were some translation philosophies that none of the other translations really had to deal with. So we have on one end of the spectrum, if you look on Bible translations, and you look on one end of the spectrum, you have paraphrase versions, all right? Which the first major one was the Phillips translation in England. And then the Living Bible came out in the U.S. in the 1960s. Then the Good News for Modern Man, all right? Those were paraphrase versions. Then you have other ones like the New Living Letters. Then the Contemporary English Version, or the CEV. That's another paraphrase that was out there. Then the Message, if you want to put it in that category. All right, so that gives you a sense of what's on that end of the spectrum. And then, so they're really not doing a literal translation of the Bible. What they're doing is reading the text and then putting it in their own words. You know, they're reading, you know, Romans chapter 11, and then they're saying, this is what it means. They're putting it in their own words, those paraphrase versions. And the thing that we have to ask for paraphrase version is, what if, you know, what he thinks is wrong, or whoever is doing that? So it's kind of like a commentary, if you will. And so that's one end of the spectrum, paraphrase version. On the other end of the spectrum, you have literal translations. But then there are degrees of literalness, all right? It's a whole continuum, if you will. You have editions like the King James and the NASB, New King James and so forth, that are attempting a word-for-word translation as best as you can. They're called formal equivalent or fluid equivalent translations. And then when you have what is called, on the same side, the literalness scale, you have what is called dynamic equivalent translations. And dynamic equivalent translations are not exactly word for word. It's more thought for thought. And the goal of a thought for thought translation is to make it more readable. Because when you do a new translation, the whole goal is to not be accused of plagiarism. So you have to change at least 20% of the words to be different. So you have to think about how hard it is to come up with a new translation. You have to change 20% of the words from something else. And so you don't want to be guilty of plagiarism. And so there comes a point where, especially with modern translations, you run out of words. You know, you're going to have to start inventing words at that point. Especially with so many translations coming out at the same time. So they have to be pretty creative. And some of these creative words don't always represent the original text well. And it doesn't mean that some of them are bad. You know, some are. But it just shows that they're writing with a different translation purpose. And so when we come to the NIV, we looked at that verse from Romans 1:16, for example, a few minutes ago. The translation philosophy is to try and make the thing a little bit smoother and less rigid. And so you might see a word left out to make it read smoother. Or sometimes words might be interpreted rather than translated. We'll look at an example, Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4. Again, remember, the King James Version, the NASB, the NIV, all had two goals. They had two goals, literalness and readability. All right? All those translations had those same two goals. For the King James, NASB, the first goal was what? What do you think it was? Nope. The King James and NASB, their number one was literalness, and their second was readability. For NIV, what do you think it was? Readability, literalness. You know, same two goals. All right? Romans chapter 4, and those are some good goals to have, by the way. Everybody should have those goals. But sometimes when you're trying to make it readable, you'll interpret words not found in the text. Now, I included those in your notes as well if you want to see it. But Romans 4, 5, but to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is credited as righteousness. King James, Romans 4, 5, but to him that worketh not, but believeth on him that justifieth the ungodly, his faith is counted for righteousness. Romans 4, 5 in the NIV, however, to the man who does not work, but trusts God, who justifies the wicked, his faith is credited as righteousness. What do we see change there? We see him, and then it was changed to God. Now let's look a little deeper at this, because the Greek says him. And when you look at it, it says him and not theos. Theos is the word for God. And so what the NIV has done is to interpret the pronoun for us. And that's typically when a word is translated in the Bible as God, typically what member of the Trinity are we referring to? God the Father. And, it's typically God's Father. So not always, though. All right? It doesn't always happen that way. But this is interpreted as God here. So the average reader perhaps might think that this is God the Father. Even some people believe that this is God the Son. You know, some people interpret this passage when it says, because he intercedes for the saints. A lot of people think it's God the Son. But some people might, by the term God, think it's God the Father. But the point is that it's interpreted rather than the reader making a decision. Let's look at another example, Romans 8, 27. Verse 27 in the NASB, and he who searches the hearts knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because he intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. It's same in the King James, Romans 8, 27 in the NIV, and he who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints in accordance with the will of God. What does the Holman say?
And he who searches the hearts knows the Spirit's mindset, because he intercedes for the saints according to the will of God.
Okay. All right. And so we see a difference there. The he there, the second he, is interpreted as Spirit, which, by the way, is correct. It's correct. Even though the Greek uses the word he. And so it's not an issue of correct or not correct, because we see that's correct. It's an issue of interpreting the text versus allowing the reader to interpret it for themselves. And so what we have to do is to check in any translation that interprets the text. And there are others out there. You know, the NIV tends to do a good job at that. But there are some other translations out there that interpret the text, and they may interpret it wrong. And so we have to know, and as we go along and we look at some further ones, we'll look at ones that do that. And it's good to know that so that we know whether we could trust it or not. One more example, Romans 8:35. I bolded that phrase in your notes, for your sake, verse 36, Romans 8:36. For your sake we are being put to death all day long. King James, for thy sake we are killed all day long. NIV, for your sake we face death all day long. And so it's a difference there, you know, between being put to death, facing death, and being killed. Another example is 1 Corinthians 7:1, which we won't look at tonight. You could look at that. But the genius of the NIV, I'll tell you this, was that it was packaged under so many names. Name them. Men's Devotional Bible. Busy Woman's Bible. You name it. You've seen them all. It was packaged under all these Bibles, and it sold over 100 million copies that are out there. And so I'm not trying to bash the translation, even though many people have bashed it. Perhaps you've heard some of the names of it, the Nearly Inspired Version, the Not Intended Version, the New International Perversion. But it gets really villainized out there, but it's a good translation, and many people have come to Christ reading that translation. But I wanted to point out some of these issues. So when you're choosing a Bible translation, you have to ask the question, do I want a translation that's as close to the original or that interprets it thought for thought, paraphrase, those kind of things? Those are things that you have to look at. Many people have said, I want a translation that has interpreted the text. And if that's the case, that's fine. We just need to be careful to make sure that we can trust that translation. That's the important piece. Gail, and then George.
Now, there's a new one.
Yep.
You're going to get to that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. George.
Yeah. The NIV, I thought, actually was missing verses compared to like the NASB or the King James. For example, in the NIV, you don't really know if the Philippian, I guess the eunuch, was actually saved or not, because we're missing verses there. Also, the NIV uses a different source material than the KJV or the NASB.
And we looked at some of that in terms of verse issues, and we looked at it back when we were looking at the King James, and we you know, like blood or words or verses, and we looked at the translation philosophy. In some cases, and a couple weeks ago we looked at some of these actually, where we looked at in Mark, where in Matthew chapter, John chapter 8, remember? The issue of the adulterous woman in those cases where they have to make decisions about, do we think this was in the original or not? And then in those cases, they might have put it in the notes. And so, yeah, they all use different source material. The NASB uses a different and puts a focus on different source material than the King James did, you know, and that's part of the rub. The King James uses more of the Byzantine. And we were talking about that just a few weeks ago, and the NASB kind of pulls on some of the more recent manuscripts, like the Nestle, like we just talked about, or they use a lot of stuff found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the NIV tends to pull from some of the more modern stuff, too. And so that's some of the rub that's out there, is that, you know, folks who say that the King James is the best translation would say, you know, the Byzantine has been around so long, you know, why are all these other translations, manuscripts popping up? You know, why are they just found? And, you know, when you compare them, you know, and we've looked at some of those comparisons, it's 99.9% the same. You know, the difference are some of those words or some of those verses that people debate, that, as we've said, doesn't change doctrine at all. So it's a hard science to really figure that out and to come to the bottom of it. But they all agree on 99.9% of the issues of doctrine and faith. Yeah. John.
If we think a paraphrase is on the left end of the spectrum and literal is on the right, are you saying that NIV is on the literal end, like left of the far right, or where is it in that?
Yeah, if you have the literal and then you have maybe 2 degrees, this is my opinion, you would have, it would be the second degree, you know, so you have the word for word. So like I mentioned, the NASB King James puts literalness first. They said that's the first thing we're going to do, and then readability second. It's on the same spectrum. The only thing is the NIV says we're going to put readability first and then literalness second. Yeah, not that they're compromising per se, but they want it to be smooth. What else?
Well, the paraphrase could take a little bit too far. I know the original Living Bible really took some liberalities with the text that were definitely not what the text said. I guess it's okay for the objective that he had when he began the work,
paraphrase, King James
version. Mm-hmm. Right.
It's kind of a family project.
And it kind of took off.
It did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you just have to understand what you're using, you know. And for a kid, there comes a point where, you know, you're going to start reading them. You see a lot of those kids' Bibles, it's just the major stories, some of them, you know, and you're reading them to your kid. Nothing's wrong with reading that. You just need to know that. And then at some point, you need to then make a decision where you're going to go with your kids. You know, like 3 years ago when we went to the bookstore for several hours. Yeah, days. But yeah, it's, you know, it's important to know. Or if you're going to give somebody a gift of a Bible, you know, there's some that you might not necessarily agree with. You know, I know somebody who gave an unsaved person the Green Bible. You ever heard of that? It was made on like all recycled paper, and the letters are also in green. But the person he gave it to was also, you know, a green person. And so, you know, he thought she might read this because it's on recycled paper. It's, and, you know, and I looked at it, and was it the most awful thing? No. You know, there's some different, you know, interpretations or ways that they would translate certain things. There are certain passages that I tend to look at. You know, I look at Genesis 1:1. I look at, you know, just some passage in James, St. Peter, Revelation. I look at a bunch of places, and it wasn't the most awful, but, the you know, he had a goal in mind that because it agreed with her philosophy, maybe she'll read this and kind of go through this. And God saved people in a lot of ways that we don't even think about. So, you know, it's good to know about these kind of things because we might lead somebody to Christ and then we're going to buy them a Bible. What Bible we're going to buy them, you know, and if you make a decision on a certain type of Bible, you're going to need how, if you're discipling that person now, then you'll need to know how to explain certain things. You know, a student was in my office the other day, and she needed help with her Bible homework. So I said, I'll help her. I went to a student group meeting. She said, I'm Genesis 12 to 50. The assignment's about the character of God. So nobody could, I said, come by my office. And she's reading from a Catholic Bible. And, of course, this student didn't grow up in church, has no context of the Bible whatsoever. And so I'm trying to not put my thesis in terms of where she wanted to go with her paper. But she had one thought about where she wanted to go with the chapter. And I'm trying to explain, you know, in 12 through 50, wow, you see, this is the formation of Israel here. You know, look at the significance. You know, she just wasn't getting it. But we were reading from different Bibles. She's like, wait, this says this. You know, so sometimes when you're sitting with somebody with some different translations, you need to know how to explain why it says that, and why this account's different, or why it reads different, or whatever. We need to know that. So that's kind of why we're doing this. All right, next time we're going to do the New King James Version, the New English Bible, and I forget what else, the New Revised Standard Version, NRSV, all right, working our way up to some of the newer ones. And, boy, there's some stuff in the NRSV that will get the hair on the back of your head standing up, perhaps, all right? So clip those here so they don't stand up. All right. John, would you close us in prayer? Would you?
Thank you very much, Pastor, for another informative session here with our bibliology. We are closing things out. Things are beginning to wind down, but we've done a lot of work up to this point, and to help us really understand how to answer some of those questions, especially with the proliferation of all of the new modern translations out there, and the little details that are omitted are really not that minor when we look at some of the issues, the underlining issues and the subtle nature with which the enemy seeks to corrupt the pure word of God. So we hope you're enjoying these studies. You can find everything on our website. You can find some of those charts and things that Pastor Conway was talking about. That translation chart will be attached to some of these last few sessions to just to give you a little bit of a visual to what he's saying. So we embed the episodes right into the site, and so you can track some of that stuff down. We hope you're enjoying this. You can find everything at www.amos37.com. That looks like AMOS, the numbers 37.com. All of our social media content is there, and our new email update, which comes out once a week, which just kind of updates you on some of the ministry activity over the week, some of the things that you updated. Because not everything makes it to Facebook or whatever particular media device you prefer. So we hope you're enjoying that. God bless. And until next time, may God richly bless you as you continue to grow in the grace and knowledge of Him.
So I wait for you. Oh, I wait for you. I'm falling on my knees, offering all of me. Jesus, you're all this heart is living for. I'm falling on my knees, offering. Jesus, you're